Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Henry Manayan, your host and chair for tonight. It is my pleasure to introduce Steve Case, entrepreneur and best-selling author of The Third Wave, an entrepreneur's vision for the future. Steve is known for co-founding AOL, the first internet company to ever go public. In 2005, he co-founded Revolution, an investment firm based out of Washington, D.C., that has supported nearly 100 companies like Zipcar and Sweetgreen. Steve was selected by President Obama to serve as the founding chairman of the Startup America Partnership, an initiative launched by the White House to accelerate high-growth entrepreneurship throughout the country. He also serves as a presidential ambassador for global entrepreneurship and is a member of President Obama's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. Steve sits on the National Advisory Council on Innovation and Entrepreneurship and is chairman of the Case Foundation. Also joining us is Eric Ries, entrepreneur and author of The Lean Startup. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Steve Case and Eric Ries.
Thanks, everybody, for making it. It's really an honor to be here with you, Steve, so thanks.
Thanks for doing it. Great to have you.
Thanks for coming out to Silicon Valley, and thanks for writing the book. I mean, as an entrepreneur myself, as someone who works with a lot of entrepreneurs, I feel like the lessons you shared in here are incredibly valuable, and I'm really gratified to see the book do so well.
Well, thank you very much.
Congratulations.
I appreciate it.
So let's start with the third wave, and what do you mean by that? You know, walk us through the thesis of the book, the three waves of the internet. Why did you write the book, and what do you want people to take away from it?
Well, first of all, thanks for coming. It's great to see you all here. And Eric is quite an impressive author, having written The Lean Startup 5 years ago, which has been a bestseller for all 5 years. I've resisted writing a book for 57 years, but finally decided it was time. And the reason was because I was thinking about, particularly traveling around the country, meeting a lot of entrepreneurs, focused on a lot of different sectors, that something was changing around entrepreneurship. And that the third wave was going to be different than the second wave, but actually could learn some lessons for the first wave. So for me, it was an opportunity to write about the future while also telling some stories from the past. And just to kind of set it up, the first wave was just building the internet. The second wave has been building apps and services on top of the internet. And the third wave, which is just now beginning, is integrating the internet in seamless and pervasive ways throughout our lives. And in the process, changed pretty fundamental things like how our kids learn and how we manage our healthcare and energy and transportation and food and financial services. A lot of things have changed somewhat in the first and second wave, but not that much, and are going to change a lot in the third wave, but it's going to be different. It's, I think, a different mindset and needs a different playbook than the second wave, which is more about the apps. And some of those lessons from the first wave, as I said, are applicable. It is funny to say this now, 31 years after we started AOL in 1985, but when we started, only 3% of people were online. And those 3% were online on average 1 hour a week. So we've come a long way in 31 years, and that first wave was really building the infrastructure, the software, the servers, and the networks, and getting people to buy PCs and getting modems built into PCs and driving down the communication costs, a whole bunch of things. It really took a decade before they finally happened. In the beginning of the first wave, nobody knew what the internet was or cared, and the sense was it would probably just be a kind of a hobbyist market, never a mainstream market. By the end of that first wave, everybody was connected, and they realized it really was a pretty transformative capability, which then set up this second wave and the great successes like Facebook and Twitter and Waze and Snapchat and so forth that had been basically apps running on smartphones for the most part, and huge successes there. But it now kind of leads into this third wave, and that's why I decided to write the book.
So the book is kind of epic in scope, and you can get a sense of, it weaves in elements of your personal story.
Epic
plus
in
this
scope. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. Maybe I should get your blurb, epic in scope.
You can write that
Eric
down.
Eric Ries, right. The Lean Startup.
Listen, unlike in 1985, someone could tweet that right now, and next thing you know.
Exactly.
You would
please
be hearing
do
about,
tweet
yeah,
that.
So,
epic in scope.
Go right
Eric
ahead.
Eric Ries,
hashtag
Lean Startup
the third wave.
The third wave.
That's my, if I would tweet it, except I'm doing this.
I might stop right now and tweet it myself. Don't forget those beautiful line. You're a poet.
It's my pleasure. Really, the least I could do for a fellow author.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, and I was thinking.
That's why I wrote the book. I wanted to be in the fellow author club.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't respect you if you haven't written the book. You're an author.
Listen, I'm a highbrow author.
It's
an honor to be in any kind of club with Steve, let me tell you.
Well, you're kind.
And I was thinking just to myself, he said 1 hour a week in 1995. I was like, how do they Snapchat then? what did they do 1 hour? The policy prescriptions, your like time working with the White House is like a lot of interesting stuff to talk about. But for me as an entrepreneur, I always want to start with your personal story and like how you became an entrepreneur in the first place. And like at a time when it seemed crazy for people to get people online, like how did you take that up as your mission and why did you think that was your little piece of the world to work on?
Well, a couple parts to that. I got interested in being an entrepreneur when I was a kid, like 10, 11, started some businesses with my brother Dan, I should say, by the way. His son, Alex, is here. Alex, you want to wave yourself? And his fiance, Brianna, they get married in 2 weeks, is also here. So congratulations to Alex and Brianna. I'm sure they're now mortified that they came and sat in the front row. But my brother Dan and I started a number of different businesses when we were relatively young. It was just little things, but it got me interested. Then in college, I happened to read when I was a senior in 1980 a book also called The Third Wave by Alvin Toffler. And some of you may have read it. Toffler was a futurist. He also wrote The Future Shock and some other things. And when I read this 36 years ago, I was completely mesmerized. I was like, he was talking about sort of this electronic cottage and this future where people would connect with each other over, these different technologies and access information, basically talking about what we now think of as the internet. But it was very futuristic in 1980. And I just said, that's the path I want to follow. When I graduated from college, there were no internet companies to go to, and there really wasn't a startup culture back then. So I worked for a couple big companies for 3-4 years, and then kind of moved to D.C., joined a startup, which promptly failed, which is like, oh, welcome to the NFL. It's like startup stuff is sometimes doesn't work the first time. And I had two other people I met at that company. We started AOL in 1985. And that was, a pretty circuitous path to eventually kind of break through. I used to say that we were kind of like a 10-year-in-the-making overnight success. That, for most of those 10 years, it looked iffy. And even I'd get calls from time to time from my parents who'd be like, and I knew it was going to where it was going when this call would start like this. Steve, we love you, and we're proud of you, but this online thing, it doesn't seem to be working. Have you considered like a real job, maybe like a plan B or something? But we stuck with it and finally broke through. And in retrospect, when I started, I was 25, 26, and I was, naive, and I thought it was so obvious that everybody would get connected quickly. And it was surprising to me that it took so much time and was so slow. But in retrospect, I can look back and most people didn't have PCs. Back then, some of you will remember, you actually had to go to the peripheral section of the computer store to buy this thing called a modem. It was defined as sort of an optional, non-essential part of computing. Seems crazy now, but that's what it was in the 1980s. And if you actually went to the trouble of getting connected, you'd pay about $10 an hour to be online. It's kind of intimidating, and the software to get online was kind of hard, and if you did get online, there actually wasn't much to do, and there was nobody to talk to, because it was still pretty early, so it just took a while to build the core infrastructure and get people connected, and so that's why it really took a decade. So for me, it was sort of circuitous from some of these businesses when I was a kid to being interested in this. Initially, it didn't work with the first startup, and
First of all, just for people who've never been through a startup failure, talk about what that was like, and then how did you decide to keep going? I mean, I know a lot of people who their first taste of the startup life ends in failure. They feel like, it's not going to be like in the movies, forget it. I'll go back to my regular life. Like, why did you continue to keep going?
Some stubbornness, I guess, but also some passion about the idea of the internet. I just knew it was going to happen. I didn't know our company would survive when it did happen. There were some, come dark days, but I just knew it was going to happen. That was helpful. It was sort of a I always saw this kind of light at the end of the tunnel. Granted, sometimes the tunnel seemed long and the light seemed flickering, but I just knew. So I just stuck with it, and the team we had, you know, kind of stuck with it and finally broke through. But we went, the other thing that's kind of amusing in retrospect, when we went public in 1992, as you heard, it was the first internet company to go public. We'd been at it for 7 years. We had 184,000 subscribers after 7 years. Wow. 7 years later, we had 25 million subscribers. So it was, you know, the first 7 years, it was hard, and it was a struggle, and even the IPO, I remember, like it was yesterday, even though it was 24 years ago, meeting with institutional investors and, you know, talking about, like, this internet and people connecting on their PCs, and they're looking at us like, you are insane. You know, first of all, no normal person will ever do this. And second of all, you've been at it for 7 years, and you have 184,000 people you've suckered into doing it. Obviously, it's not a big idea. And we raised in that IPO $10 million, and the value of the company that day was $70 million. And then 8 years later, it was $160 billion. So, you know, a lot of people were skeptical initially, but eventually we kind of, you know, broke through, and that really was kind of defined that whole first wave.
You talk a lot about lessons that we can learn in the third wave from the first wave and the importance, you know, in that time of persevering through and having that kind of larger vision. I think for those of us who grew up with the internet, it's actually kind of difficult to imagine what the controversy was, because it seems so obvious that, of course, I mean, we carry the internet in our phones and we're on it 24/7. Like, what was the count? Like, you said that everyone's going to want to connect. I know you talk about in the book that people are the killer app of the internet. Like, explain what you mean by that, and then, like, what were these bankers saying? Like, how could anyone possibly argue with that? Like, how did it not seem obvious? You know, now it's easy for us to say, well, of course, so clear in retrospect, but
it wasn't just the bankers. I mean, there are a lot of companies early on in the 80s, early 80s, were intrigued with this idea, AT&T and Knight Ritter and Time Inc. and Citibank and IBM and Sears and Reader's Digest. You know, a lot of, you know, pretty significant companies were saying, this is interesting and we should explore it. But for the most part, they explored it. The initial reaction was tepid. There wasn't a lot of consumer interest in it. And they kind of said, well, maybe people don't want to be connected. You know, we tried. You know, it's not working. So, you know, let's go on to the next thing. And what they missed there was that the idea of getting connected was intriguing, even though it was kind of foreign to people. They didn't really understand, you know, how to process it. It just wasn't yet ready for prime time. It was still too expensive. It was still too hard to use. It wasn't that useful. It wasn't fun. You know, so you just kept whacking away at that. Eventually, you would break through. And I think that's a lesson for, you know, innovators, and, you know, particularly in big companies, that, you know, that does require kind of a long-term view and does require sticking with it, because often the initial take, sometimes the initial several, you know, kind of attempts just won't quite work, but eventually if you stick with it, it can work. But in terms of the lessons from the first wave, you know, there's three in particular. I call in the book the three P's, and it's perseverance, partnership, and policy. You know, we were not alone in you know, the first wave of struggling to kind of break through. It took a while for most companies to raise money. Took a while for most companies to, you know, to get traction. And the second wave, less so. There have been some true overnight successes in the second wave. Facebook actually is an overnight success. It went from a dorm room startup to a significant company overnight. Snapchat, same kind of thing. It was basically Instagram, same kind of thing. Pretty much an overnight success. And that was not the case in the first wave. I do not think it will be the case in the third wave. I think some of these sectors, the opportunity to change healthcare and education is significant, but it's hard. It's going to take time, and perseverance is going to matter. So that's one. The second is partners. In the first wave, it was all about partnerships. We could not have done it without the communications companies, the PC companies, and the modem companies, and the media companies, and, you know, the financial services companies. Everybody had to do their part. And it was sort of a tapestry of alliances. I think we had at AOL like 300 partnerships that, you know, kind of made this, you know, possible. In the second wave, that was less common as well. It was more about the app, more about the software. Facebook didn't need any partnerships. You know, kind of, it just was. People just fell in love with the idea and spread it virally, and it wasn't really about, you know, partners weren't that important. will become important again in the third wave, because you want to change, call it healthcare, kind of have to work with the hospitals or the health plans. It's not just about the app. You want to change education, have our kids learn in a more personalized, adaptive way, you kind of have to work with the teachers and like work with the classrooms and work with the schools and work with the universities. So it's not so much just about the software partnerships will matter. And the third is policy. You know, and again, people, particularly frankly in Silicon Valley, don't like to hear this, but the government's going to play more of a role in the third wave than it did in the second wave. And it also played a big role in the first wave.
Yeah, I think it's hard for people to really remember all the like controversial policy issues that came up in the first wave, and talk about what that experience was like, and then we'll see if there's some lessons people could draw for the third wave.
It's worth noting that the internet only exists because of government funding of DARPA that created the internet. Initially, it was restricted to non-commercial use. It was only available to government institutions and educational institutions. Consumers could not connect to the internet. Businesses could not connect to the internet until 1991. So our first few years after we launched, we were kind of creating this kind of parallel universe. So the government created it. The government then commercialized it with this Telecom Act Congress passed. The government also decided to break up the phone company, Ma Bell, into a series of regional companies that unleashed a torrent of innovation in telecommunications. And if that hadn't happened, the internet never would have taken off. So there was a series of moves that basically, you know, that made the internet possible because of, you know, kind of government action. The second wave, the government was for the most part on the sidelines. That it was, there were some exceptions to this, and particularly when companies got really big, Facebook, for example, when they passed 1 billion users, people say, well, we should look at privacy and some other things. But it wasn't really that important for most of that. But it will become important again in this third wave. So there were just a lot of different dynamics where the government was, and I'm not like saying government's great. You know, government's broken and it's dysfunctional, and it's weird how, you know, kind of how bad things sometimes are, and some of the regulations are stupid and need to get changed. I'm not saying, you know, oh, awesome, government's going to, you know, be playing a more important role. I'm just saying that is the reality of the sectors that are going to get disrupted. We might all rail against the government, but at the same time, we actually do want the drugs that our parents take to help them, not kill them. We actually do want the food our kids eat at school to be safe and not make them sick. We actually do want, when we get on a plane, you know, to feel like it's not going to crash, and drones not, you know, aren't going to create problems, and driverless cars, autonomous vehicles, smart cities, really interested, kind of want to make sure that they are safe and they're going to be a net positive to society, not a net negative. So the reality is this stuff really is important stuff. It's how we eat and how we learn and how we stay healthy and how we invest and how we, you know, kind of, you know, think about energy and how we move around, pretty fundamental aspects. And the government, there are going to be some regulations involved, and the innovators just have to understand that and figure out a way to, kind of engage in a constructive way. And just sort of wishing it wasn't the case is going to be a problem. And trying to enter some markets, you know, ignoring the laws is sometimes going to be a problem. Sometimes you can get away with it. Uber actually has gotten away with it. At least in this country, they're shut down in Germany, they're shut down in South Korea, where the, you know, government said, nope, you can't do it. So that's an example where they pushed the envelope and they were able to get a lot of traction. But there are other companies, particularly in healthcare. 23andMe had this problem a couple of years ago in the genetics area. They made some claims that the government thought was inappropriate. They shut them down. They had went to zero revenue for like a year until they got on track. Theranos now has some issues around, you know, some regulatory kind of approval kind of thing. So this is just the nature of the third wave, and the entrepreneurs and the innovators, whether it be the small companies or the big companies who want to grab that opportunity, which is vast. Healthcare, for example, is 1/6 of the economy. So there are going to be some gigantic companies built in the third wave. It's just going to require this mindset where perseverance is going to be important, partnerships are going to be important, and policy is going to be important.
So if I think about, I'm sure we have, you know, listening right now, entrepreneurs who feel like they want to do in the third wave what you did in the first wave, and they are completely convinced that their vision, just like you saw something that could play out over 10 years, they're completely right, and they know that there's these difficult obstacles, and right this very second, maybe they're not seeing the kind of traction that would let them go public. Well, what's your advice for them? Like, how do they think about, am I, You have that moment as an entrepreneur, you're like, am I crazy? Am I the only one that sees this? Am I delusional or am I onto something? How did you sort through that, and how do you advise the entrepreneurs you work with now how they should sort through those questions? Like, is it time to pivot or just keep going?
Yeah, I think it kind of depends on what the market's telling you. Are you getting traction with customers? But that's why the partnerships are important. The partnerships actually can be an accelerator of growth. If you're trying to do it on your own, maybe you can only go so far. If you actually have partners, you have opportunity to go a lot faster. But that getting the partners is an interesting market test as well. If you're trying to get partners and everybody's saying no, maybe there's a reason they're saying no, and maybe you have to adjust something you're doing to reflect that. Our early days, our first 5 years, we had a partnership with Commodore with a Commodore 64 computer. We had a partnership with Radio Shack with their computer. We had a partnership with IBM with their computer, and we had a partnership with Apple, not down the way, create something called Apple Inc. Personal Edition. Those were hard partnerships to form, but we were able to convince them that this was something they should invest in and they should partner with us to do it. And they made us better because of the questions they asked and the pushback around a whole host of things. So I think the partner aspect is important. But at the core, it's, do you really believe that idea is something that's going to have a significant impact? And can you then identify what the limitations, the roadblocks are, and then systematically kind of work on kind of knocking them down? And sometimes your initial idea is a bad idea. As I said, the first company I joined in D.C. in 1983 turned out to be a bad idea, even though when it got announced, it seemed like a really good idea. But it failed. And so we, rather than say, okay, that proves that people don't want to go online, we said, well, actually, let's look at why it failed. And there actually were some reasons. And let's start again, and which we did with AOL, and kind of address learn from what those mistakes were and seize some of the new opportunities that had emerged in the meantime.
It's good that you did.
It's good that
we did. we all appreciate it. Thanks, everybody who's sending questions up. A lot of questions here are about specific sectors that are going to be affected in the third wave. You've mentioned healthcare, education, financial services. What are some of the upcoming disruptions that you're most excited about or that you think maybe people are underestimating?
Well, I think there are a lot of them. And the one sector that doesn't get as much attention because it's not viewed as much as a tech sector is food. I think food is a $5 trillion industry. It's something that investors talk about total addressable market, TAM. Food, 100%. We all eat. In this country, you think it's three meals a day. It's actually 4.6 meals a day. That's the current data. And most of the food we eat, most people in most parts of the country isn't great. There's a whole this big food complex, and it's kind of more industrialized, processed. I wouldn't call it all junk food, but it's not great. And there are a lot of entrepreneurs that are attacking that in a variety of different ways. And technology is a part of that, but it's not the core of that. I think that's a very exciting space in financial services, fintech. There's a lot of really interesting things happening. There's a big debate around the big banks. Are they too big to fail? And what should the regulations be? I think in the third wave, they might prove to be too big to innovate, that they're going to get chipped away by thousands of startups doing interesting things. A lot of things like lending platforms for the unbanked, that people don't have access to traditional sources of borrowing other than like payday lenders that kind of rip them off. There are a lot of people looking at that, and so I think there are all kinds of opportunities in that space. Transportation, we talked about. Obviously, we've seen some of that with Uber and other things in recent years, and Tesla. But it's going to really accelerate in this third wave, and it's going to change how we think about kind of moving around. So these are pretty fundamental kind of parts of our life, pretty significant sectors, but they won't be easy. One of the points I make in the book is sometimes revolutions happen in more evolutionary ways, and it's not it's quick to happen as you might think.
Do you have an example of an evolutionary revolution?
The first wave was really all about that evolutionary revolution. It was a struggle for most companies until finally it broke through. I remember having a meeting probably now 8 or 9 years ago. Nelson Mandela at his home in Africa, and he said something I'll never forget, which is, "Always seems impossible until it happens." I think that is kind of the lesson on perseverance and the lesson on these revolutions happening in an evolutionary way. It seems so elusive. It seems like, wow, it's just never going to happen, never going to happen. But if you really believe and you really stick with it, eventually it's going to happen, and you just need to make sure you're still on the playing field when it does happen.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of questions about specific things from the AOL history, including what was the inspiration for the You've Got Mail audio clip. So before we go into the future looking, can we hear about You've Got Mail and maybe those 30
million CDs? Well, it was part of an
CDs.
Overall effort in the late 80s, 89 probably, maybe 88, to try to make it friendlier. You know, as I said, the part of the reason the internet was not taking off, it was threatening. It was kind of scary. And so we said, it's only going to work if it's easy to use, useful, fun, and affordable. And so how do we make it more approachable? That's part of the reason we created like free software and gave it, you probably got one of our discs at some point in your life, maybe more than one. And you know, made it a free trial. We just wanted to make it as easy as possible for people to try and to make it feel more approachable, more human. You know, we were talking about ways to do it. I remember it was our customer service group. This is when we had maybe 30 employees, so it was maybe 5 people in customer service. And I was saying, how do we make this friendlier? How do we make it seem more approachable? Maybe we can add voices to the software so that it sort of, when you signed on, it would say welcome and things like that. And one of the customer service people, Karen Edwards was her name, kind of overheard me say that and said, well, like my husband, Elwood, actually does like voiceovers. He's a radio guy. I'll ask him to record some stuff tonight. What should he say? Like, I'll post it and wrote, welcome, You've Got Mail. Like 5 or 6 things. Completely spur of the moment. So he took those home. He recorded them on cassette that night, brought it back the next day. His voice was perfect. And so he threw it on the software a couple weeks later, and then, a few years later, he's one of the most iconic voices in the country, completely by accident, because Karen happened to overhear a conversation, and so that was an example of just trying to make it more friendly, more accessible. So for similar reasons, some of you may remember that for probably 15 years, I wrote a monthly letter to members. I wanted everybody to feel like they were part of this movement. They were part of this, they were pioneers too. And so report on what's going, what we're adding, any problems we had, almost like I was the mayor of the community, not just the CEO of a company. That was another example of trying to make it seem more friendly and approachable. And every time anybody joined the service, there was a welcome email from me welcoming the service and giving them some tips, which seemed really good when we were adding a few thousand customers a month. At one point, we were adding more than 1 million customers a month. And you know what? A lot of people clicked reply. And at one point, I think I was getting, I can't remember what the number was, like 20,000 emails a month. We had a whole team of like 20 people that were called the Steve Case email team. So that was one, or maybe it's still, I think, a good thing. But, I realized that after a while, I could no longer answer the emails itself. But it was all, how do you make it more personal, make people feel like they're part of this revolution?
So we've got a lot of questions about how large companies can be successful in the third wave. And I think, you have a very interesting perspective, both as having grown a very large company and then, having now working with entrepreneurs and companies of all different sizes. How do you feel like the legacy companies are going to do in the third wave?
I think it's a mix. I'll answer, but I'd love you to answer, given some of your lean startup perspective and work with a lot of big companies. I think the simple answer is some companies will fail. They'll just be left on the wayside. And some companies will succeed. And the difference between them will partly be the culture they build internally around innovation, kind of an entrepreneurial mindset, but mostly the network they build around the company. I think there's a growing recognition that no matter how great your company is, no matter how many smart people you think work for your company, more people work for somebody else, not for you. And so how do you tap into that? How do you build sort of this network around your company and watch what's happening on the periphery and recognize that entrepreneurs have interesting ideas and figure out a way for those interesting ideas and those interesting people to find their way to you? And figuring out ways to do that as companies get large is tricky, but that's going to be one of the real skill sets in the third wave. But the reason big companies are going to have more of an opportunity in the third wave than they did in the second wave is the startups are going to need them. they're going to need partnerships with some of the incumbents in some of these sectors. You know, healthcare, for example, I mentioned the hospitals and health plans and so forth. If you just think it's about software, you just think it's an app in the App Store, you're only going to go so far with that. You're going to really have to figure out how to connect with things, you know, the key organizations in those sectors, and that will mean you'll want those partnerships to accelerate your growth. They'll want those partnerships to stay relevant and nimble and flexible and agile. So I think that's going to be great. But what would you say? You work with a lot of pretty big companies now, even though it started as a lean startup thing and people perceived it as very small startup oriented. The reality is what you're trying to do and have done is educate a lot of really big companies about how they can be more entrepreneurial. So yeah, let me turn the tables.
Oh,
here.
No problem. It's my pleasure. One of my favorite things to say to entrepreneurs is because a lot of people, they become entrepreneurs because they hate working in big companies and they're trying to escape the bureaucracy. And I always say, if you hate big companies so much, why are you trying to create a new one? Right? Like if you're going to create the very thing that you hate, unless you've really given some thought to what kind of a company do you want to build? What do you want that culture to be? And everyone said, well, I want my company to be a perpetual startup, even as it grows. And I always ask them, you know, the follow-up question to that is, okay, great. Well, who's in charge of making sure that that happens? Because you have a head of marketing, you have a head of engineering, you have a head of supply chain, you have a head of HR, a head of finance. Like you have people who are responsible for each of the important functions of the company. Who's responsible for the entrepreneurship challenge that you face? Who is making sure that those networks inside and outside the company are interlinked? Who's making sure that people who have entrepreneurial ideas inside the company in a meritocratic way can be invested in, you know, can try things even if they kind of cause the innovator's dilemma and freak people in the company out? And the answer to that question in most companies is nobody. And it's no surprise that they behave the way that they do because they build this kind of top-down command and control, very traditional bureaucratic structure. And I think companies that are organized that way, you know, they're not going to be able to survive the kind of forces that you're talking about because sitting here, no matter how smart we are, we can't foresee this disruption in every single industry all at once. And the ripple effects of that, it's too much to hope that we'll be able to predict. So building a management culture and a management system, processes, finance, accounting, IT, HR that are designed around making sure people are resilient in the face of multiple failures, making sure people are adapting and iterating quickly. I mean, that's a whole different management toolkit than most of these companies are designed around.
So maybe we should do a joint book together, The Lean Startup in the Third Wave.
The third wave, yeah.
Corporate disruption.
Yeah, do you ever get any comparisons to third wave feminism?
I've not yet. Yeah, there are a lot of third waves, though. If you search on like Twitter on third wave, there's like third wave coffee and third wave this and third wave that. So we had to go with third wave book, just to be clear what we're.
Oh, this is the third wave book. I see. Third wave coffee sounds delicious.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a good segue. We got a question from the audience, which is, has the advent of the digital age democratized entrepreneurship and innovation? And they also have a little asterisk. If so, has it made it easier for Hawaii to diversify its economy?
Well, I'm from Hawaii, so So here's my take on this. And I say this respectfully sitting in Silicon Valley, that Silicon Valley is awesome. And the innovation in Silicon Valley is awesome and will continue to be awesome. And it's got a, as you know, because you're here, an incredible ecosystem with talent and capital and sort of this fearless culture. And that's wonderful and that will continue. But there's also some arrogance in Silicon Valley that basically says that all great innovative companies and people are in Silicon Valley. And the realities are not. They're spread all around the country, indeed all around the world. And I think one of the things that's going to happen in the third wave is going to see a broadening of innovation. And that's not to say Silicon Valley won't still be in the lead. I think it will be in the lead. But it is to say you're going to see what I call in the book the rise of the rest and the rise of different regions, again, both within the country and around the world. I think it's a good thing. It's going to be a great thing for those communities, a great thing to, you know, give more people an opportunity. Last year, for example, 75% of venture capital went to three states. California, you win, New York, and Massachusetts, 75%. And that does not reflect the distribution of great entrepreneurs with great ideas. And it's actually worse if you dig a little deeper. About 90% went to men, 10% to women. Does not reflect the distribution. People of color, even worse. And so what may seem here like anybody with an idea has a shot and access to capital, it's not true. In parts of this area, and it's certainly not true in many parts of the the country. So one of the pushes we have is to democratize access to entrepreneurship, democratize access to opportunity. One of the great things about the internet, it was did level the playing field, give everybody access to information. I think that's been incredibly powerful. We have not yet democratized access to opportunity and created entrepreneurial culture and almost like an on-ramp for people who have ideas. And I remind people that Mark Zuckerberg, when he came up with the idea of Facebook, which is a huge success, and even today they announced their earnings, it's unbelievable what they're doing. So hats off to him. But Mark happened to be at Harvard and happened to have a rich friend across the hall. Most people aren't at Harvard. And you know what? Most people don't have a rich friend. So if they had the idea, probably wouldn't happen. So how do you make sure everybody, everywhere, of every background, who has an idea, has a shot? That was part of the idea of Startup America. It's part of the idea of this Rise to the Rest. It's partly why my investment firm, Revolution, basically says we're invest our capital outside of Silicon Valley. It's not that we don't love Silicon Valley, but everybody else is investing in Silicon Valley. Valuations actually tend to be a little high as a result. We'd rather invest in other places. So we invested in Shinola in Detroit. Big investment. They're bringing manufacturing jobs back to Detroit, building a great brand. It's going to be a very valuable company. You know what the founder of that company's goal was and purpose was? Create jobs. That actually was the founding kind of purpose of the company. And he's created a couple thousand jobs, and it's created a sense of hope and possibility in Detroit. So looking for companies that are trying to do that. They're trying to lift up their region. They're trying to inject purpose as well as profit in what they're doing. I think that's going to help define and really animate the third wave. So yeah, we've made progress. And in this case, I give some credit to the government that 4 years ago, the Congress passed the Jobs Act, as you know, the Jumpstarting Our Business Startups Act, bunch of things in it. But a big aspect was crowdfunding. And the reason that's important is if you look at the crowdfunding project sites like Indiegogo and Kickstarter, nearly half of the successful projects have a woman as a founder. Nearly half, yet 10% of venture capital goes to women. What's the balance? It suggests it's more the networks and who you know and who people are comfortable with. On this one, it's like watching the video on Kickstarter and saying, that coolest cooler is pretty cool, or that other thing is pretty interesting. I'll buy that thing. You actually don't really care who the person is. You don't really care where they're located. They could be in San Francisco. They also could be in Des Moines. You're basically investing in that idea. So that does help level the playing field, and I think that will be a big thing to watch and encourage in this third wave.
It's terrifying for our friends in consumer packaged goods and consumer products, because all of a sudden they're competing with millions of people.
And there are some
the
platforms like Circle Up that it is essentially an investment platform that is exclusively focused on consumer goods, and some really interesting kind of products are being launched on. But the successful companies there are figuring that out. And so I was in Cincinnati a few months ago. Procter & Gamble is in Cincinnati, great consumer packaged goods company. They're now doing a lot of stuff in Cincinnati and more broadly to actually understand what the entrepreneurs are doing and figuring some of those what could be partners. They could maybe distribute the product. Some of them could be acquisitions. So rather than just focus on what P&G is inventing, the new Prel or Sure deodorant or we're gonna still do that, but also figure out what's happening around the periphery and partner with some of those entrepreneurs.
Do you feel like there's business model innovation that's distinctive for the third wave that's different than what we've seen before?
Absolutely. It depends on the sector, but it's partly part of the point of the book. Of course, technology is important. Of course, the internet's important. I think that is important. But it's the other aspects that are going to likely define some of the success and failure. So whether it be business model innovation or success in terms of partnerships or success on the policy side, actually partnership and policy at the core are people skills, not coding skills. And if you get that right, you have the ability to build relationships and build trust with potential partners or with potential regulators. That's going to be really important in the third wave, which doesn't mean the coding doesn't continue to be important. Of course it does, but it's not just about the app. It's not just about the software. It's a much more complicated and nuanced process around innovation.
I appreciate you calling out the lack of diversity in the ecosystem, and you know, the idea that not everybody has equal access. I feel like that conversation needs to be had more and more often. One of the things I hear a lot when I talk about that or try to engage with that topic here is people say, well, listen, technology is a meritocracy. The internet is a meritocracy. So there, by definition, there can't be any problem. As if meritocracy was like a binary switch that you flip, and then once you've done it, then you're completely done. You know, you must encounter that kind of thinking. Like, how do we make the ecosystem more meritocratic? How do we bring more people into it? And level that playing field to make it, you know, access more equal.
I think there sometimes, and this is not true with everybody, obviously, but there's some people who do have a view that technology solves every problem. And if you just throw software at it, it's going to solve the problem. As I said before, of course software is part of the answer, but it's not the only part of the answer, and it requires a much more complicated approach to things. And so the idea that somehow technology, because you know technically anybody can code and technically anybody can create an app, so therefore technically everybody has a shot, and it just you know whoever happens to be the winners, it just happened that it's a complete meritocracy. That's just really not true. And it does happen to have a correlation to who you know, happens to have a correlation to what school you went to, happens to have a correlation to if you're a white guy, it seems to be working better. That's the reality. And so it will change over time. I think some of these Rise of the Rest regions, I think, are leading the way. There's some cities that are basically say one of the most important things they're trying to do as a city is create an environment for inclusive entrepreneurship, a deliberate stated objective where the community is rallying around trying to, with impact hubs or opportunity hubs, different things in different, communities where they're really saying this community wants to be differentiated, not just based on the kind of companies we do, focused on ed tech or focused on health tech or what have you, but the philosophy we bring to entrepreneurship. And some are focusing on inclusive entrepreneurship, some are focusing on impact investing. There are different ways people are trying to differentiate. And I think that's great. It's sort of how do you make sure that people really do have a sense of a possibility.
So out here we have a lot of people that think that technology will solve everything. In our audience, we have people who feel a little bit differently and have a number of questions here. This one came with a headline associated with it. I like the headline, all caps, social/political unrest due to the third wave. That's the topic category. Now I'm going to ask you this question. Given our current political landscape.
E for social unrest? The book just came out 3 weeks ago. Come on, give me a break.
Given our current political landscape of populism. Thanks a lot, Steve. Well done. And income inequality, what do you predict in a few years with AI, automation, everything you're talking about with third wave that would exacerbate this inequality? Do you think it's going to get better or worse because of the third wave?
It's going to get better and worse. I think there absolutely are going to be jobs that are lost because of technology, productivity gains. And we've already seen kind of the many middle-class jobs hollowed out, and that's part of the reason people are frustrated. And you see that even in the election this year. There are a lot of people who do feel left out. They really do feel it's not fair. They really do feel they don't have a shot. So there's absolutely going to be that kind of thing. At the same time, I think we've seen a arc of history where while some jobs and even some sectors kind of go by the wayside, other things emerge that often surprise. 100 years ago, 98% of us were in farming, agriculture. Now it's 2%. The people went out of that business, and part of that reason you only need 2% is because of automation. And people say, well, that doesn't seem like a particularly good career anymore, and I'll go do something else. And they get trained in different ways for different skills. And we just need to continue to innovate. We need more companies like the example I met with Shinola, where it's not just focused on eliminating jobs, but focused on creating jobs. And that's where some of the impact investing kind of mentality is. The other thing I should say is that even the definition of jobs, the definition of work, has changed a lot. Right now, 34% of people say they're part of the freelance economy. Millions of people are part of this gig economy, what some people call the flexible economy. It didn't even exist 5 years ago. And it's strange to watch in the pace of this, because when I was a kid, the model was you went to work for a big company. Like my dad worked for one organization for 60 years.
So when I had 3 jobs in 3 years out of college, they were a little freaked out. It's like, Steve's not going, this is a problem. And now there's some people.
I'll interrupt you there because we got a question here, which is clearly a hypothetical question. How do you deal with parents that are concerned that your entrepreneurial journey is not going well or something like that?
My case, they were in Hawaii and I was in Washington, D.C. So I think maybe distance is a good thing. Now, they were actually supportive. They're just worried. They're just feeling like, this path is going to work out. But I understand that. They're a little more. My dad was a lawyer. My mom was a teacher. A little more cautious. A little more generational thing. But I particularly one of the things I talked about, some of the negatives of Silicon Valley. One of the things that really is great is this sense of possibility, the fearlessness the community brings. There are many parts of the country, including by the way Hawaii, that are risk averse. They kind of clinging to the past. They actually are scared of the future. And that does not create the right environment for entrepreneurship. So part of the message with Startup America and Rise of the Rest is how do these communities rally together, create more network density, create more connections and collaboration within the community, and try to change the dynamic. And what I ask people to think about in these communities I visited is when you hear a startup pitch, does your mind immediately go to why it might fail or why it might succeed? Most people in most parts of this country focus on why it's going to fail. Silicon Valley, actually, there's always going to be some skepticism. It's more like, maybe that's kind of interesting. Maybe that will succeed. And having that sense of possibility, not reckless, not crazy, but just sort of the sense of why it might work as opposed to why it might not work, is actually a critical ingredient to create a vibrant kind of entrepreneurial community.
Yeah, so we've got a question here about how is the third wave going to impact the emerging economies of the world? We've been talking kind of in a U.S.-centric way, and I certainly appreciate what you've done with Rise of the Rest to spread the message that this can be a kind of a source of American renewal, but what's the global perspective?
Yeah, I think there's 2 parts to it. And I spent a little time on both. A lot of the focus, and I guess my real passion, is how do we make sure this country remains the most innovative entrepreneurial nation in the world, which I think is possible, but it's not given. I think some people get a little cocky and complacent, thinking somehow there's something so unique about the American pioneering spirit that we're always going to be a leader. And there are a lot of countries that have figured out, the secret sauce that's powered the whole story of America is innovation, entrepreneurship, and are changing their policy. So how do you make sure the rest is rising? How do you make sure the playing field is leveled? All those are part of it. At the same time, I do think it's important to essentially educate people all around the world of the power of entrepreneurship. We've done some work through the Case Foundation, mostly my wife Jean, in the West Bank. Started a venture capital fund 4 or 5 years ago there to create jobs in places like Ramallah. There's a reason why that was a very difficult, scary, dangerous place, is most people, particularly young people, had no hope. And so creating a sense of hope and by creating jobs and growing companies was a way to do that. We've also done a number of things. Last summer we were actually with President Obama in Africa or in Kenya and Nigeria and Ghana. It's amazing what's happening there. And some of the greatest innovations there, we made some investments like in energy with solar and rural villages creating energy that we all take for granted here. Most parts of Africa, they don't have access to any basic infrastructure, and suddenly they have access to a way to recharge their phone and access to light their dwelling, and it really is a game changer. And the perspective they bring, because they're close to the problem, they identify solutions, entrepreneurial solutions, that people sitting here or in New York would never even think of. It's not even on their radar. But because they're living that and understanding the problem firsthand, they're creating opportunities. So I think Africa now has pivoted in the last decade from a problem to an opportunity. It went from kind of Africa, all these challenges, needs more grants, and there obviously are a lot of challenges, and more grants are important, but much more Africa open for business, an enormous opportunity. Now, investors, not just philanthropists, investors are focused on that. And more recently in Cuba, what's happened in the last year is remarkable. I was there about a year and a half ago, and the entrepreneurial spirit there is terrific. It just for half a century has been bottled up. And as things are unleashed there, I think it's going to be incredibly entrepreneurial and create a sense of of a possibility there. So I think, of course, we need to focus on this country, and of course we need to focus on people left out and focus on communities that don't have, you know, job growth and so forth. But we also need to recognize the best way to have a safe, peaceful world is to have a more prosperous world where people feel there really is opportunity.
So that's probably not a hypothetical question, but political leaders around the world in communities, you know, who ask you for advice, you know, how do we create a more pro-entrepreneurship public policy? What do you think are the critical elements of that? What are your prescriptions to do that?
It varies depending on the place. Obviously, there's some parts of the world, including many parts of Africa, where there's some pretty fundamental things like rule of law and other things that need to kind of be put in place. And in this country, there's a handful of things I think are important. One of them I talked about, creating this, you know, culture around risk-taking and creating more connections, more, you know, network density in these different communities, making sure the regulatory environment in terms of what they're doing is supportive of that, recognizing that the real job creators are not the big companies, but the startups. The Kauffman Foundation data there is pretty compelling. Is that 40 million jobs have been created in the last three decades by young, high-growth startups. That small business in general, restaurants, dry cleaners, you know, come and go. There's not a lot of net job creation. It's important, adds up to a lot of jobs, but not a lot of job growth. Big companies, Fortune 500 companies, not a lot of job growth. It's really these young companies. So instead of trying to lure, you know, some corporate headquarters to move, try to lure talent to move and capital to move, so you can, you know, launch more companies there, and then build more connections with the big companies in the region. So they go back to what we were talking about before. It's not the startups feeling like they're off on their own and nobody cares what they're doing. It's how do you create more of those different connections? So a bunch of things that need to happen depending on where in that cycle things are.
So what about, you know, things like, I think, kind of topics of controversy today, right? Things like should states and, you know, have enforceable non-competes, right? In California, you can't enforce a non-compete against an employee. Some people feel like a stronger social safety net makes people more likely to take a risk. That was a big part of the Obamacare debate. Are there kind of specific concrete policies, obviously giving people who want to come to the United States and work as entrepreneurs a visa? We currently have no visa category for entrepreneurs, which seems crazy to me. You know, kind of, do you have specific kind of favorite policies you'd like to see politicians embrace?
I think you've touched on some of them. I think we need to have a whole chapter in the book about America disrupted and both the risks but also potentially opportunities, and lay out half a dozen things. What you talk about, immigration is one of them. I understand immigration is like a super sensitive, hot issue, particularly this election year, and it's also many facets to it. But as you say, you know, we part of the reason we've been so successful is we have been an immigrant nation. 40% of Fortune 500 companies have an immigrant founder. About 40% of Silicon Valley successful companies have an immigrant founder. It was 50% 10 years ago, by the way. We've lost 10 points in 10 years because we made it harder to stay here. One example I mentioned is Snapdeal. This is a company that started by a Wharton graduate in the United States. He wanted to stay, couldn't extend his visa, had to leave, went home to India, moved the company there. And now they have 5,000 employees, they're worth $5 billion. And he wanted to stay here. And I hear those stories all the time. So immigration is one. Regulations, particularly around some of these sectors and the convergence of these sectors in the third wave, is another. Investment incentives around capital, making sure things like crowdfunding work so every entrepreneur anywhere who has an idea has a shot there. It's a bunch of things that you know, can be done and I think need to be done.
One of the things I appreciate about your perspective here is that, unlike a lot of folks who opine on these topics, you've actually done a lot of constructive engagement with government. In the government, you were on the White House Jobs Council. You've worked directly with President Obama. You worked with both Democrats and Republicans on the Jobs Act and a number of initiatives. So, talk a little bit about how that originally came about and what's it like to work with the president.
Well, it came about 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, I should say I've lived in Washington now for over 30 years, and in that first wave of the internet, when the internet was coming of age, worked closely with the Clinton White House then, and did some also things with President Bush when he was president, and more recently with President Obama. So I've always stayed out of the politics and focused more on policy, and tried to be kind of a nonpartisan, kind of behind the scenes kind of bridge builder. And whoever the next president is, whoever is controlling the Congress, I'll do what I can to be helpful in trying to move some of these things forward.
No matter who it is?
No matter who it is. You know, there's some I'd prefer over others, I admit it, even though I won't tell you who, but there's some that might scare me a little bit. But whoever the president is, I'm there and try to do my part to be helpful to the country.
That's patriotism right there.
There it is. But you know, the more recent thing, about 5-6 years ago, I was asked to co-chair the National Advisory Council on Innovation and Entrepreneurship. That led to a series of recommendations, including the White House, that they start this initiative called Startup America. And then the president asked me to lead that, and then created this Jobs Council chaired by Jeff Immelt, the CEO of GE. And I was on that and led the effort, along with John Dorff, Kleiner Perkins here, Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook here, a number of things around entrepreneurship. And that, you know, they just kind of one thing led to another. One of the big recommendations of the Jobs Council was around capital, and that led to essentially proposing a series of things, which then led to, in this case, the Republican majority leader at the time, Eric Cantor, proposing the Jobs Act that was building on these White House recommendations, and that, you know, that went through, you know, Congress. And I've, you know, also been working on the immigration, you know, issue. So it depends on what the issue. It depends on, you know, what the environment is right now. Nothing's going to happen in an election year around immigration, for example. But hopefully, come January, we'll get that back on the front burner.
I mean, when the Congress passed the Jobs Act with your assistance, that was 2012. That was also an election year. That was, I mean, for people who remember, a highly polarized time in Congress. I felt like at that time, Congress was doing almost nothing. Very few things could pass. And then all of a sudden, this bipartisan, almost unanimously passed legislation happened that, you know, from the perspective of folks outside of D.C., seemed almost like magic. What was the magic?
Well, it was building some relationships over a longer period of time, and getting people on both sides to realize that if at the time also the unemployment was about 9%, so there's actually really concern about, you know, jobs. Now it's more like 5%, and it was a broad concern. And in an election year, jobs, the economy was becoming a big issue. That educating about the role of startups we just talked about, and the need to, you know, make sure that entrepreneurs with ideas had access to capital, because banks had stopped lending and most people didn't have access to capital. And so the overall legislation was around that. And there were many parts to it. And it updated securities laws that hadn't changed since 1933. So 80 years they hadn't changed. Pre-internet, amazing that nothing had changed around the securities laws. So just educating people about that. And then the White House, the president coming out in support of some of the recommendations was a signal on the Democratic side. Eric Cantor coming out and proposing legislation was a signal on the Republican side, and Cantor's staff cleverly called it the Jobs Act, and so it seemed like, how can you not support the Jobs Act? It was sort of a clever framing of the issue, and people did say, when I was working on it, I said, like, why are you wasting your time on this thing? There's no way it's going to happen in an election year. But, you know, it just you know, came together relatively quickly and passed.
So we have a lot of grab bag of questions people are asking. You know, some of them are parochial to Silicon Valley, some of them are about you personally. So I'll try to go through a few quickly while we have a few minutes left. Obviously, the IPO culture. I mean, when you were describing the terms of the AOL IPO, I mean, compared to the size of rounds of private financing, public financing that we see today, it, you know, couldn't be more different. Someone asks, do you think that the billion-dollar VC funds are the beginning of the end of the second wave? How is venture capital going to operate in the third wave, and what's going to happen to these, well, he didn't say dinosaurs, but very large funds?
Well, I think there is some data that suggests if you're too large a venture fund, you have, you know, generally, you know, kind of weaker returns because you're investing in a broad array of things, and some concentration tends to works. Small-ish funds tend to do better than larger funds. But my own view is that crowdfunding is a game changer in terms of providing that initial capital, but there is a role for institutional venture capital to provide the larger $5, $10 million investment, and certainly the much larger $25, $50 million investment. That's less likely to come from crowdfunding. And it's not just about the capital. And I think the need for expertise around partnerships, policy, some of the things we've been talking about is going to become more important in the third wave. So investors aren't just writing checks. They're also rolling up their sleeves and helping companies. And the ones that do that effectively, I think, will do well. The ones who are simply, you know, kind of making investments, I think they will do less well.
You talked in the book about having a philosophy as a company builder of built to last versus built to flip. And that felt like a very topical idea for kind of the wave of, you know, a lot of second wave entrepreneurs, I think, who saw this kind of a gold rush and a kind of a quick way to have, you know, an overnight success. Help us understand that kind of philosophical difference and why you think it's important in the third wave.
And also, I want to be clear, just the same reason I said, you know, Silicon Valley is awesome, will continue to be awesome, even though the rest will rise. And the second wave, some of the successes were tremendous and really, really should be, you know, celebrated. So I don't want to come off as somehow, you know, I'm anti-Silicon Valley or not, you know, supportive of second wave innovation or entrepreneurship. I am. At the same time, there absolutely have been some entrepreneurs who are take a shorter term mindset and if it's not working really quickly, they give up on it, or they take it to a certain level and then sell it, and you know they do four or five companies, and that's fine, the notion of, you know, serial entrepreneurs, but I would prefer people not focusing on another dating app or voting app or photo app or, you know, whatever. Not that they're unimportant, but I think improving how we deliver healthcare is more important. Improving how our kids learn is more important. Improving our food systems are more important. Improving our, you know, energy and transportation infrastructure is more important. But they're also harder and they're more frustrating and they'll take longer. And I'll celebrate any entrepreneur who wants to do anything, but I will celebrate even more the entrepreneurs who are taking on important aspects of our lives with a kind of a built to last, I'm going to persevere, I'm going to partner, I'm going to engage, I'm going to somehow figure out a way to break through.
All right, another question we said, what do you recommend today's college students study? And what majors or extra courses would you advise them to?
Of course,
tackle.
They should all be studying the Lean Startup, I think it's a mix. I'd be curious to get your perspective on this too. I think it's a mix. I do think that the skills and around coding are important, and encouraging more people who have that interest and aptitude. I think that is important, but it's not the be all and end all. I actually think, and just particularly in K-12, we need to do a better job of I wouldn't say teaching creativity, because I think most people in kindergarten are creative. We just kind of squeeze it out of them by the time they graduate. So instilling that sense of wonder, that sense of possibility, asking questions in new ways, seeing the world in different ways, that in some ways is a critical ingredient around innovation and entrepreneurship. And the other goes back to what I said before about people skills, that it's not just about the software. You've got to figure out some way to build the partnerships. You've got to figure out some way to engage on with regulators and others that are going to be at the table. And so those skills, relationship skills, people skills are also important. And just being able to connect the dots. I mean, at the core, you know, entrepreneurs are good pattern recognizers. They see a lot of things happening and they figure out how to connect the dots in a way that, you know, takes an idea and gives it life.
I mean, I was a computer science major, but at a liberal arts school, and I just want to really underline that having the broader perspective so that you don't have the arrogance to think every new idea you had is like the first time anyone in history ever had that idea is a very valuable skill and an important antidote to the arrogance we sometimes see in our ecosystem. Okay, so we got time for one last question. I tried to get as many as I could.
Just randomly pick.
Okay, all right, well... This one, let me just do this, and then we'll do the real last question. Someone wants to know if the fact that the third wave chapter starts on the page 42 was intentional, because that's the answer to everything, life, the universe, and everything. Is that some kind of esoteric Douglas Adams reference?
That's a question I've not heard yet on the
well done, this book, nice work.
Book tour. Now, actually, the way I thought about the book is I really, as I said at the very beginning, I really wanted to write a book about the future, and... So I only wanted to tell stories about the past when, like Shakespeare said, the past is prologue, and some of those stories about the past would help inform the future. So trying to weave something together that was more about where things are going, more about the playbook, the mindset that's necessary there, and then kind of linking back to some of the things that we saw in the first wave, some lessons learned. It was tricky to figure out how to do that, but I actually did not focus on exactly what page the third wave began on.
You managed to turn the last question into a very substantive answer, as you have this whole time, so I really appreciate it. And just as a reminder, everybody, the book is The Third Wave. You should make sure you buy it right away.
Thank you, Eric, and thank you all for coming. Appreciate it.
Really, thank you. All right. We're not yet.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. We would like to thank Steve Case, entrepreneur and author of The Third Wave and Entrepreneur's Vision of the Future, Eric Ries, entrepreneur and author of The Lean Startup, our audience here in Santa Clara, and those of you joining us on the radio and web. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.